so just kind of ignore her and just know that it's going to keep recording. And welcome to Lacrosse Talk, everybody. I'm Dan Matthews with Max Frater, and it is Sunday, January 11th. We're 2 weeks into the National Lacrosse League season, and Max, it's been quite the season so far.
You know, I can't tell if I want to call today the day of great comebacks or the day of blown leads. I don't know if I want to be either glass half empty or half full, because that's the way things kind of played out yesterday. A huge offensive performance from a ton of different teams and a lot of sloppy play. I mean, you take a look at some of these games and the penalty log is almost just as long as how many goals were scored in the game between both teams. There was a lot of fighting. There were a lot of minors, a lot of fighting majors, 10-minute penalties going on. If you look at the Rochester game, those guys not happy to be 0-2 right now.
No, Rochester, the defending world champions in box lacrosse. Sitting at 0-2, but Max, this is not uncommon for Rochester to get off to a slow start and be playing their best lacrosse when it really matters.
It's true, and it's something that we had talked about in our preseason, kind of looking over everything that's going on in the NLL, that they're going to be the guys that have the target on their back. They know that. They've had that for the past three seasons when they've been the champs. So every team going into playing the Nighthawks is looking to put together their best possible performance. And I think that happened yesterday. I mean, you look at Toronto in week one, too. And when we spoke with Coach Lovell, and he said the biggest issue they had to address was on the defensive side of the ball. That's exactly where they played their best ball in the second half. You could say that for the Rochester game last week. You could say that for the Vancouver game this week. So Toronto, one of those teams who's streaking right now 2-0. And then both teams who were in the finals last year, Calgary and Rochester, 0-2 early on in the season, but still a little bit telling.
And we're only a few weeks away from the start of the collegiate lacrosse season, so we'll be starting our previews of D1, the MCLA, and D2 in NCAA a little bit later on this morning. Should be a real exciting season. As we look at preseason number one, Denver, here in our backyard. And will they stay there? Probably not. You know, I look at their schedule. I look at kind of what's going on. And, you know, I think we're going to see a lot of shakeup in the top five during the course of the season.
I mean, how could you not? Especially when you're looking at the majority of the top five are in the best conferences in college lacrosse. I mean, you look at the SEC in football and how those guys pan out throughout the course of the year just because they beat each other up. It's such a gauntlet playing in those kind of divisions week in and week out. So you're looking at Denver, Duke, Notre Dame, Syracuse, Maryland, who just recently jumped out of the ACC. They might not have as much movement, but when you're looking at the ACC guys, the Ivy League guys, you could take a look at the conference Loyola is in right
Patriot
now.
League.
Yeah, Patriot League, thank you. You look at the Patriot League as well. I mean, those guys are playing each other twice a year. You know there's going to be some upsets in there. And so Denver, I think, has a great chance of kind of maintaining that, but I would watch out for some of the bigger teams, Villanova, Marquette even, in the Big East.
Denver's going to have to look over their shoulder in all likelihood during the course of the season, just with their non-conference schedule with games early with Duke and Notre Dame. You win those, and you certainly have a chance to sit at number one and be there all year long with that Big East schedule. And we talked a little bit last year about whether or not the Big East move for the University of Denver is a good move and will keep them as competitive as they need to be throughout the course of a season. Most people last year felt like, yes, it was okay. This year, maybe a little bit different story is you sit at that number one spot, and then is your strength of schedule strong enough to keep you there during the course of the year?
I mean, you could imagine Denver went through the same issue as last year, as people kind of questioning whether they'd be tournament ready after playing through a Big East schedule and winning the Big East Conference. And, I mean, they proved everybody wrong, being so close to going back or going to their first final, coming up short against Duke. But, I mean, we've been talking about them for months now. I mean, their roster just goes so deep. And you look at the preseason all-conference team for the Big East, and you see right there the first three attackmen in the midfielder, Denver. You got Wes Berg, Jack Bobstein, Zach Miller, who had a fantastic freshman year, Eric Adamson. You're not even counting the Cannizzaro brothers. And then you got Ryan LaPlante in goal. I mean, there's very few weak spots on that team. So it's going to be fun to watch them, and depending on if they can coast through the Big East Conference, they might have an undefeated regular season.
We'll dive real deep into the ACC, America East, and Big East with Terry Foy a bit later on. We'll also talk to Brian Shanahan, our NLL insider, about the first 2 weeks of the National Lacrosse League season. And we'll also be talking with Jack Coyne, NCAA Division II. Blaine Harrison, head coach of the New England Black Wolves. Who would have guessed? They're off to a 2-0 start in the National Lacrosse League. And we're going to sandwich that all in the middle of MCLA. We'll kick off here in just a moment with Tim Haslam doing our MCLA Division II preview. And then we're going to sandwich that on the back end, and we're going to talk with Jake Hubert. Jake, a graduate of North Dakota State University, and Jake is also the founder and CEO of Tilt Clothing Company, a lacrosse apparel manufacturer. So without any further ado, let's bring in Tim Haslam. Hey, Tim, thanks for taking the time to join us here on Lacrosse Talk. We sure appreciate you making the time here today.
No problem.
Tim, we're going to spend some time with you as our new MCLA guru, talking some preview stuff. And we're going to start this week with Division II. And Division II is kind of the stepchild of the MCLA, if you will. Wouldn't you think that's a fair assessment?
I mean, in the lacrosse world, the MCLA as a whole is probably the stepchild. But within the MCLA, D2 is certainly the stepchild, I'd say.
Tim, when I look at the MCLA and kind of the comings and goings, if you will, the one thing that really stands out to me, and we had him on the show earlier in the year, was that Pete Moosbrugger is no longer the head coach at St. Thomas. That's being turned over to longtime assistant Brian Gross. How will Brian fare as he takes over this Tommy's squad?
You know, it's interesting. Obviously, he'll go one of two ways. He'll either continue to in Pete's shoes, or he'll fail miserably. I guess there's some room for just being mediocre, but so it'll be interesting. I mean, he's been on staff for many years, and so he knows the system, he knows what's going on, he knows what to do. So in my opinion, I think that he'll do just fine, and they'll be able to get back in the championship game again. You know, they didn't go last year, which is now the first time in what, 4 or 5 seasons probably,
right,
that they didn't make the championship game. And so, certainly they have high expectations, and Brian obviously knows those expectations. And so I think they'll be fine.
Tim, thanks for joining us on the show today. I mean, just kind of looking at the way that MCLA D2 finished out last year, I mean, not having St. Thomas and Westminster 1 and 2 for the first time, and I don't even know how long. You've got Grand Valley State and St. John's in the title game. Do you feel like that was kind of a good break for MCLA Division II, just for the kids coming into it saying, you know what, there's a little bit of a change in the hierarchy and there's a chance for my team to move into that top spot?
To answer your question, yeah. Probably not too much, though. And the reason I say that is, you know, you look at the top 4 or 5, and they're all Midwest teams, more or less. So if I'm down in the SCLC, and I'm not seeing much change as far as that goes. But, yeah, I mean, you know, Grand Valley State's always had a good program. St. John's has always been good. Dayton's always been good. And so it is good for them. I'm sure that they loved St. Thomas having them down here. And obviously Westminster going to D1. But like I said, you know, the team's at the top have changed, but really that where they're from haven't. You know what I mean?
Right.
Speaking of where they're from, it's really kind of counterintuitive to the way Division I strikes out, and that the power conferences are not at all the same as what we see in the D1 ranks.
That's true, you know, and I'm still trying to figure that one out. It could just be that, you know, back east and in the Midwest, some of the bigger schools are becoming NCAA sanctioned. You know, I think of Marquette and Michigan, obviously. And out west they aren't, and so you've got your big D1 programs out here, obviously Arizona State, Colorado, Colorado State. Like, as you guys know, you know, I'm obviously more familiar with Utah, BYU, Westminster, even though Westminster is a small school. But, yeah, in D2, it's, you know, it's the CCLA, it's the UMLC, it's the GRC, and, you know, occasionally you'll find just a phenomenal team out of the SCLC. And so, you know, that's kind of what makes D2 fun, you know, is you get these small colleges that are just a couple, you know, that aren't far from each other, and you get them in there competing where, you know, in D1, it's kind of it's the bigger schools, you know, and it's the name brands, you know, it's Oregon, it's Arizona State, it's the big schools. So it's fun to watch. It's fun to pay attention to, you know, every year when the new schedules and teams are released, you know, it's always fun going through D2 and being like, okay, this school, like, I didn't even know this school existed, you know? And so it's good to see that and see some of these schools that come out of nowhere who put together a team and are ready to play.
So, Tim, with the regular season for the entire MCLA and all of lacrosse really coming in within the next 2 months, how do you see the MCLA D2 shaping out? I mean, are we going to see Grand Valley State and St. John's as number one and number two? What about a team like Grove City that made huge strides last year, or even a team like Western Oregon who went, I believe it was 14-0 in the regular season? So where are we going to see these teams fall once the season starts in March?
You know, I think it'll be very similar to how it ended last year. You know, I don't see Grand Valley really losing much. St. John's is going to be great again. You know, they lost Jacob Helmer, who was, as I said, their go-to guy. But, you know, they'll probably just reload. North Dakota State's going to be great. They only lost 15 goals to graduation last year. You know, St. Thomas will be in the mix. Dayton will be in the mix. Grove City, to answer your question, you know, they lost three times to Dayton last season. And so they'll surely have, you know, a rematch circle to them. But their question mark is who they're going to replace in goal, you know. The Dembski brothers have been, you know, at the helm of the goalie for a long, long time. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But, you know, I think it'll be good. That's probably where I'd put my stock if I was a betting man in D2. It'd be, you know, Grand Valley, St. John's, North Dakota State, Dayton. You know, to answer your question about Western Oregon, you know, they always put together a good team. You know, it's just about getting over the hump for them. And so in the playoffs. And so that'll be the key for them is, you know, obviously they'll likely make the playoffs, but then, you know, can they excel to that next level?
You're listening to Lacrosse Talk with Dan Matthews and Max Frater. We're joined by our MCLA insider, Tim Haslam. And Tim, as I look at the top 20 that you put out for Lacrosse Magazine, the two teams that I noticed that have slipped fairly substantially from where they've sat in previous and recent years are Indiana Tech and Palm Beach Atlantic. Are those two just facing down years, or are they in for a little bit of a slide?
You know, it's hard. I don't know if you or any of the listeners have ever tried to legitimately put down a top 20, but sometimes teams just kind of, for lack of a better term, they just kind of fall by the wayside. And so, you know, who knows what Palm Beach Atlantic will do? You know, they've got Nick, I'm going to butcher his name, but probably Scalzo back. You know, he had 64 goals last season. Their problem is the defense. You know, if they can get their defense going, then they'll be right up there, you know. Indiana Tech, I don't know a ton about, but, you know, they had some great games last year. They play in a tough conference, though, you know. And so Westminster was kind of in that boat last year with the tough conference thing, you know. It's when you're in a conference with Colorado, Colorado State, BYU, you know, you could be a top five team, but you've got to go up against those guys, and you know, the polls will kind of say, oh, they're a top 15 team. You know what I mean? So that's probably just the case there with those two teams in the Tech and Palm Beach Atlantic. But, you know, at the end of the day, we'll see how it plays out.
Conversely, 2 years ago, the Dayton Flyers lost head coach Charlie Mark, and that 2 years ago, prior to the last season. And here they are for the second successive year in a position where it looks like they could very well be competing for a championship.
That's right. You know, and that goes to, you know, the first question about Coach Musburger leaving. You know, when a new coach comes in, they've got, like I said, two choices. And it's to continue on and help the team to get to the next level, or it's to fail. And so Dayton's certainly done that, you know, and they've always had a good program. And, you know, it was interesting. I don't know if you guys follow college basketball, but my Utah Utes have been doing well this year. And I've heard a lot about Coach Kostowiak on the radio. And, you know, the national pundits are saying instead of building teams, he's built a program. And I think, you know, that's what Dayton's done, obviously, is they build a program. So, you know, pieces can move in and out, but the program is still strong. And that's why they've been able to find success.
So, Tim, as far as individuals go in Division II, who are some of the big names for us and our listeners to be watching out for? Because you've got a returning Go-to-Crawl winner in Grand Valley State. You've got an incredible player on Palm Beach Atlantic who's been putting up points for years now. Who are some of these guys? What are the names that we're going to be hearing throughout the course of the season?
Yeah, you know, you asked a little bit earlier about Grove City and how they're going to do it. They've got a junior attackman named David Hall. I think he's going to be he's set up to have a phenomenal season. He led the team last year in goals with 47. You mentioned Charlie Farmer with Grand Valley State, a phenomenal player. You know, you look at his stats and nothing really jumps out, but I talked to the coach after last season, and he just said, look, this guy does everything for us. You know, if I had even one more of him, I wouldn't be worried about our midfield. You know what I mean? You know, then I put Alan Heinlein, a senior from Dayton. He had 44 goals and 26 assists last season to be on the first-team All-American slot. And then Ben Martinick, he's a senior from St. John's. And so those were really my guys that stood out to me that are set up to have good seasons this year.
Tim, when I look at the big picture from last year's tournament to your current top 20 as we enter the season, there's a glaring omission sitting there, and that's the loss of the U.S. Coast Guard to Division III lacrosse. What impact will that have on some of the balance of Division II in the MCLA, and how much will Coast Guard be missed?
You know, they'll be missed severely. You know, I remember when I was working at College Lax, I would get a press release after every game from their PR guy, Sergeant Cross. And so, you know, it's just those kind of stories that you'll miss, you know, and sure, it throws off the balance, but, you know, for every team we lost, we probably added five. So, you know, that kind of throws the balance back in our favor as far as teams. And, you know, at the end of the day, we always like to see teams go varsity as long as they're able to handle it. From an administrative side, you know, obviously it's always rough going to the next level on the playing field, but, you know, locally here, you know, I hate to keep talking about D1 because we're talking about D2, but Westminster's kind of in the same boat. You know, they're looking to go D2 and so NCAA D2. And so, you know, it's a bittersweet feeling. You know, you'll miss the Coast Guard. Obviously, their players are setting themselves up to do phenomenal things for our country. But at the same time, you couldn't be happier for someone, you know, who's been able to take their program to the next level.
So, Tim, we've got your top 20 that you released to Lacrosse Magazine for this season. We already saw how things played out in the tournament last season. What about everybody on the outside who either didn't win their conference or didn't make the tournament? Who do you see this year who could possibly kind of shake things up a little bit, come out of a slump? I'm looking at Emory right now, who's on the outside, a once very strong established program. You've also got Ryan Hart, who's constantly in the rankings. So, who are some of the teams that you see who are on the outside looking in who could possibly jump into those rankings and make the tournament in 2015?
Sure. You know, one team that stands out to me is Concordia. They've down in California. They've always had a good team. You know, Northern Colorado put together a great season last year out of the RMLC, as you guys know. you know, there's a handful in the SCLC that could do damage. You know, you've got SCAD, you've got, you know, like you mentioned, Emory, just great teams. You know, the one interesting thing for me is Utah State. Again, I know a little bit more about them just because I live here in Utah, but, you know, they played in the D1 ranks last year in kind of a D1AA in the RMLC. You know, they had some good games against, you know, Colorado, Colorado State, BYU, you know, ultimately they didn't win those games, but they've been working hard. The staff up there, John Atwood and his staff, they have a huge passion for the game. And so it'll be interesting to see what they're, you know, I would surely pick them to win the RMLC Division II. And, you know, last year, like I said, they played Colorado, Colorado State, Westminster, BYU, Utah. You know, I don't know any other Division II team that did that last year. So their guys certainly have experience, and it'll be interesting to see what they do.
And, Tim, last but not least, as we wrap up a Division II preview, last year it was Grand Valley, St. Thomas, Dayton, and St. John's. Do you foresee that Final Four being the same, or will there be somebody different come the semifinals?
Oh, that's tough to say, you know, obviously with injuries and stuff like that. But, yeah, I do. At the end of the day, those feel like good picks, at least now. You know, like I said, injuries could happen. You know, some of the other teams we've talked about could really make a run. You know, North Dakota State, two goals away from making the semifinals last year. You know, Grove City was three goals away. So, you know, that's just a couple of runs in possession, right? And so, but yeah,
absolutely.
You know, those four teams are solid, and it wouldn't surprise me if they're back in it.
Now, I'm looking for the Bison to finally break through and get to those semifinals next year.
I think a lot of people would like that.
Tim, we appreciate your time on Lacrosse Talk. We'll look forward to talking to you each and every week about the MCLA, and we'll hit you next week with our Division I preview. That's Tim Haslam joining us on Lacrosse Talk, our new MCLA insider here on the show. I am Dan Matthews with Max Frater, and without any further ado, let's bring in Terry Foy, our NCAA D1 insider. And Terry, it's kind of nice to have something to do for guys like us and you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy how quick upon us the spring has come, and I'm definitely looking forward to diving into things here, Dan.
Terry, we do this every year. We break down essentially the face-off yearbook conference by conference, starting at the letter A, and the first one that comes up is the ACC, Terry. And well, you guys have Duke sitting at number 2 overall. The coaches seem to have a little bit different perspective on the ACC as a whole.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I think, you know, as coaches go about their business, they put a lot of value on known quantities, and certainly Duke doesn't have a lot of them. But from a media perspective, you know, we try to incorporate lessons learned, and there have been very few lessons learned in the sport of lacrosse more strongly than don't bet against John Donowski.
Terry, looking at the preseason coaches poll as well, you got a tie at number 2 with Syracuse and North Carolina. At the beginning of the season, I always kind of see North Carolina as like the Dallas Cowboys of college lacrosse. I mean, on paper, up and down the roster, they're one of the more talented, not just the ACC, but all over Division I college lacrosse. They have the potential to make it to not just the tournament, but the Final Four every year, but it never ends up panning out. What do you see coming up for North Carolina this year in order for them to kind of put together an entire season to live up to that potential?
Well, it's interesting because I think that, you know, as you've seen kind of what is the model of success for D1 lacrosse change over the last 10 years, whether it be the influence of interior scoring, like, you know, from Canadian players, or, you know, just different types of sophisticated defensive sets, and you know, the way that goaltending has changed as well. Carolina, in many instances, has been kind of immune to that. and not necessarily going with the flow. And that's one of the reasons I think that you can prescribe to some of their late season struggles, but there are many more. And ultimately, I think that when you look at a team in the preseason, you tend to focus as much as possible on what kind of talent they bring back. And there's no question that Carolina has a tremendous amount of talent. And I think the thing that separates what you're looking at heading into 2015 in contrast with years past is that talent is very well distributed throughout the roster and throughout the position groups. And I think that, you know, a couple of the positions that really excite me, you know, what they have at the short stick midfield position in terms of the height, the strength, the experience. It's a really unique matchup issue. You know, what they had from freshman defenseman Austin Papani last year in terms of his ability to shut down number one attackman, relatively uncommon in the recent past at Carolina. And so I think that those are the types of things that can complement, you know, what has been common in Carolina, which is an incredibly dynamic and difficult to prepare for attack unit. That's been true for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, and that'll remain true this year. And I think that Joey Sankey and Jimmy Bitter kind of start an engine with their speed, their quickness, their toughness that will, when complemented throughout the roster, really create problems. But I think that, as also has been the case with Carolina in the recent past, you know, their season in many ways typically comes down to winning a couple of close games. And at this point in the year, it's really difficult to try to prescribe a reason that they're going to win or that they're not going to win those types of games that will end up defining their season.
Terry, historically, the ACC in round robin itself and trying to knock one another off. Is there a team that you can look at this year that you think might have a chance to run the table in the ACC and truly emerge as the top?
No, not at all. I think that, you know, the disparity that you kicked off the conversation with between the way that the face-off yearbook rankings shook out in contrast to the coaches' poll suggests that this is going to be a year where there isn't a heavy favorite in the ACC, and if one team were to emerge and run roughshod through the league, it would be a surprise. You know, I think that one of the things that's most interesting about the ACC this year, you know, Max mentioned obviously that Syracuse and Carolina were tied for second coming in, and I think that there's pretty clear reasons for that. They have very similar types of strengths offensively and defensively, and I think that, you know, that's one of those things that you can rely on moving forward. But this is a different Notre Dame team than the Notre Dame teams that we've seen in the past, and I think that that's something that will be very interesting to see how it develops. Their offensive identity heading into 2015 seems pretty clear in the way that Matt Kavanaugh and Sergio Perkovic are going to be very easily relied upon options. But there's so much more depth in terms of the guys that they can rely on to contribute from a scoring perspective. And they also, I think, down the stretch of 2014, realized how much of their strength is derived from guys like Jack Neer and Nick Costello being able to take the ball from defense to offense. And if they push the tempo, they can benefit because of the way that they can grind possessions defensively. It's what they love to do. And the way that they can score in non-conventional, non-drawn-up ways offensively to bail them out of some maybe transition mistakes. And I think that that comfort as a coaching staff, that knowing that you can still do those two things, allows you to put your foot on the gas pedal a little bit more. I'm not certain that they're going to play as fast to start 2015 as they ended 2014, but I think that we can approach the season knowing that they have that capacity, they have that gear if they need to utilize it.
So we're looking at pretty much a completely new Notre Dame team, because the Notre Dame of the past, I think, played, and then big, bold midfielders who could dodge and create opportunities. So, I mean, now that the goalkeepers got a guy like Matt Kavanaugh and Sergio Perkovic who are going to take most of the load, this side of things with Notre Dame losing Stephen O'Hara, Connor Kelly in the net, are they going to be the defense that Notre Dame has typically been, defensive strong?
I'm sorry, Max, you broke up there a little bit, but I think that the crux of your question is, are how similar are they to years past? And I would say that, you know, kind of what I just explained in terms of their ability to play faster and what they have from a known quantity perspective offensively suggests that they're a considerably different team. And, you know, that being said, I don't think that they're so good that you can expect them to roll through the ACC. But I do think that, you know, there's a pretty clear reason why the rest of the ACC coaches have a lot of faith in them.
Last question, Terry, on the ACC. Do they still hold 5 spots in the national championship tournament at the end of the year?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't see any reason why they wouldn't.
Let's move on to the American East, Terry, and Albany with a key loss or two on their squad. Looks to still be the strength of the America East. What will it take for a UMBC or a Stony Brook to potentially unseat Albany?
I mean, playing a great game in a really key opportunity or a key moment. I think that for what Albany graduated in Miles Thompson and Ty Thompson, it's certainly a clear story as to what needs to happen offensively for the Great Danes to be 80% as good as they were last year. And I think that it starts with Lyle Thompson taking a jump forward. I think it's interesting to try to project that that's going to happen because, you know, he had the type of offseason that you kind of have to have when you've been asked to do as much as he was asked to do, and that is recover from injuries. So, you know, I think that the experience that we saw him derive over the course of the World Championships and, you know, his box circuit, he's going to be a better player. But the question is it going to be a healthier player throughout the course of the season? A lot of people have made a comment that, you know, maybe losing his brother and his cousin doesn't necessarily have as big of an impact as it relates to his production as it does to how much of a beating he's going to take from opposing defenses. But I think that, you know, there's certainly been a lot of hype around Connor Field, and I think that that makes sense, but he's still going to be a freshman, and so, you know, from a lefty finisher's perspective, there's value in waiting and seeing what he's capable of doing. But, you know, with the impending addition of Seth Oaks, that's one that I think you don't really need to wait and see that much what he's capable of. I think that we've seen a lot of what he's capable of. And then in addition to that, I can speak to Lyle from an attitude perspective. You know, I had the opportunity to have a really long conversation with him in December, and I really got the sense that he's relishing the idea of being a senior leader on this team. And I think that that goes a long way. When your best player is the best player in the country and he wants to carry the mantle of being that, you're going to be a difficult team to beat. All that being said, they graduated a lot from the defensive end that I think people are kind of selling short for how much reconstruction Albany's going to have to experience at that end of the field. They still have some good talent, but I think they lost 2 close defensemen and they're lost the committee. So it's not going to be a pickup where we lost off at that end of the field either. So you expect a guy like Blaze Reardon to carry a little bit more of the load in terms of helping the defense settle in early as these new starters emerge. And then once they get settled in, you know, he can play a little bit more the way he played last year, which towards the end of the season was approaching an All-American type level.
So Terry, the America East has a newcomer in UMass Lowell, and within the past couple seasons, we've seen these first-year teams kind of rise and perform a lot better than we initially thought we would, taking a look at teams like Richmond or Marquette or High Point. What can we expect to see out of the Riverhawks in their first season in the America East?
It's a good question. I mean, I wasn't fortunate enough to get to see them play in the fall, so I can't speak to their personnel or the type of identity they're going to try to take. But one thing I can say, just on the basis of assumption, is, you know, I think that as a team, they're going to be a team who knows what type of model is successful in the America East. And I think that that's really important. It's a league that has a pretty kind of firm identity. And I think that it's a league that identity fits well with that institution. I think that's ultimately why this decision came to pass, why this ended up coming to be UMass Lowell in the America East. I think Ed Stevenson is a perfect coach for that program. And I think that because of the challenges that they're going to have in their schedule, to expect them to perform the way a couple of the teams that you just mentioned performed, whether it was Richmond or, you know, High Point or Jacksonville, you know, I think that that's a little bit of a high standard. But on the other hand, that quality schedule is going to put him in a position to, you know, play a little bit more competitively against some of the lesser teams on their schedule, in my opinion. So I wouldn't be stunned if this is a team that put together a 4 or 5 win season on the basis of parlaying the experience of playing, you know, Albany and UMBC and Stony Brook, some of the better coached, more physical teams in college lacrosse, and then, you know, turning around and, you know, whether it's NJIT or a couple of the other either, you know, programs that have consistently struggled or programs that are very new, you know, UMass Wilson put up a good fight against them consistently.
Terry, you mentioned programs that have consistently struggled. SUNY Binghamton has been one of those that consistently been toward the bottom of the American League, toward the bottom of NCAA D1 lacrosse. What's been key in their rise to now being projected, at least by the coaches, as potentially number 4 and by the Faceoff Yearbook as a top 45 team this year?
Well, I think that, you know, they've been on a positive trajectory in some aspects, and I think you look at a program with that kind of profile, and I think oftentimes it really comes down to being able to score goals. And I've talked to a lot of people about this, and sometimes it seems like you're oversimplifying, but I do think it's true, and I think that, you know, they have a depth of scoring. They have, you know, 3-4 guys that they can rely on to put in goals. And for a program like that, that can be the difference between, you know, a 3 or 4 win season and a 6 or 7 win season. And I think that, you know, with somebody like Tucker Nelson, the coach's son, who, you know, has clearly gotten better during his time at Binghamton, that's the type of leader, so to speak. It's the type of guy that can set the tone that you can turn into a good season. And so I think that's kind of where the expectations are.
Terry, let's move on over to the Big East, and you're taking a look at not only the preseason conference favorite, but preseason number 1 here on Inside Lacrosse in Denver. I mean, obviously, with the kind of roster they have and the expectations, they should sweep. They should run the table in the Big East. In your mind, who would be the one team that could possibly stand in their way this season in the Big East?
I don't know. I think that any team that would – it's similar to the type of team that's going to be able to beat Albany. They're going to have to play a really good game in a really good individual circumstance, because I don't foresee a Big East team being better than them. And I think that the team that has the most talent, depending on their injury availability, is probably Villanova. The team that I see having the most upside both this season and – over the course of a couple of seasons, is Georgetown. But then there's something about – I saw Providence play maybe 3 times last year, and even though they had from a transfer perspective, they had a couple of important guys leave, but they certainly had their top 2 scorers graduate, but they also had a couple of important guys transfer in from Army, and I think that there's something there that, they could put together that type of, you know, magical upset performance. So, I could kind of see something like that coming from any of those 3 teams, but you know, the Big East is a league where, you know, it's very interesting to me that an affiliate came in their first year was so impressive, and in their second year is carrying the water as what I think is not just the best team in the country, but one of the I just think about what they can potentially do offensively, and I see a team that I think could be historically great offensively. And that's on top of the fact that they might have, you know, 2 of the top 10 cover defensemen in college lacrosse, and they have a goalie who, if he were eligible for awards, you know, could have been an All-American level player last season. So I see so much in Denver that is really uncommon, daunting, and hard to get your head around. It's crazy to say it, but I'll put it this way. Like, I almost think that they're a team that would benefit from an injury or two offensively to clear out some room and create a little bit more opportunity in terms of guys being able to get on the field consistently. Because I think this is a team where their 3rd midfield is going to be better than a lot of teams' 1st midfield. And there's not enough run for a team to be able to turn that into a positive.
Terry, when we look at this University of Denver team for the last 2 years, they've been running the goalie rotation experiment with LaPlante and Jamie South. This is LaPlante's job now, and he's likely to be playing full games. Where will the lack of playing time in the last couple of years hurt or help LaPlante as he rolls through this season?
Well, I think the first place that it helps is that, you know, he hasn't taken the volume of beating that you typically see out of, you know, a three-year starter. So that's good. He was probably able to do more things in the offseason than he would have if he had been coming off of 2 years as a starter. The area where you can see it potentially hurting the most is just the you don't know what he is as a full-game player, both from a, you know, stamina standpoint and also from a mental toughness and concentration standpoint. You know, there was always a safety net there. And then lastly, I think that there's a question about, you know, what is Denver's defensive identity going to be in late game, in close late games, because with Jamie Foss, the idea was that he was there because he was athletic. He was the type of guy that could pick off passes, stuff like that. Ryan LaPlante is much more of an in-the-crease positional type of player. Can they be as aggressive defensively in getting the ball back as they might have been if they were down with Boston net? I have no idea, but that's part of my point when it comes to the fact that you just don't know because you haven't seen it yet. So the downside is the biggest, you know, for a team that has so many known quantities, that is one of the bigger unknown quantities. What does 60 minutes of Jamie Foss look like in contrast to 30 minutes of him. I'm sorry, Brian
the Plan. Terry, one more question on Denver, and then I want to talk about some of the other teams in this conference. The Pioneers last year, we felt, were a team that could lose positioning in the tournament because of their schedule. Have they solidified some of that this year by having teams like Penn State, Lehigh, Ohio State, Notre Dame, and North Carolina and Duke on the schedule for this year to improve that strength of schedule long term?
No, because they're, I mean, when you look at it year over year, really the biggest change is adding Carolina. And while that's good, this was a schedule heading into last season that people could have looked at and said, wow, that's pretty tough. They suffered from some of those teams having worse years than expected, you know. Ohio State, Penn State, and Lehigh all had RPIs much lower than you would have expected based on their 2013 performances. And I think that that's essentially the same position they're in right now. There's reason to believe that all of those teams are going to be good. And if they are good, then Denver's schedule will be pretty good. But they don't have the baseline of RPI in their conference schedule to have reasonable expectations that this is going to be a really high RPI team. So they're going to be one of those teams, and I think that this is going to be the case for two or three more years until, you know, some of the programs that we expect to be, you know, perennial top 25 programs once they hit their stride, like Georgetown and Marquette, end up getting there. And until that happens, you know, they're a team who the back half of their schedule is going to weigh down their RPI potential a little bit. And it doesn't – I don't think it's going to be to the point where they could potentially miss the NCAA tournament because I think that they're, you know – hope, you know, if they are as good as they think they're going to be, they will get enough quality wins to overcome whatever RPI deficiencies they might have. But on the flip side of that, I think that they are a team that might arguably be better than their seed is at the end of April. And it's funny because to me, the biggest downside to that, it's not for Denver. It's for whoever Denver's quarterfinal and Final Four opponent might end up being.
So Terry, taking a look at the rest of the league, I mean, when we were talking about the America East and Albany losing two of its major contributors in miles and pie, they're still up there at number one because of the talent they're returning and the talent they brought in. Looking at the Big East, you take a look at St. John's, who had an impact player equal to what Miles and Pie did in Kieran McArdle. And with losing all of that to graduation, is St. John's really going to be in trouble this year?
I mean, I don't know. The simple fact is that despite the fact that and it's not just Kieran McArdle, it's Kevin Cerundo and Colin Keegan as well. You know, they lost they lost two 4-year starters and a 3-year starter from that attack unit. But I think that when you look back at the last 3 years, you realize that St. John's biggest successes were in that upset kind of role. They didn't make it to the NCAA tournament. They didn't have the types of highs that you might have expected with that type of production from a program perspective. But what happened was, I think they clearly changed the identity, the expectations of what they are. And I think that they elevated the baseline performance of the St. John's program. And now their initial starting point is a lot better established than it was in previous seasons. So I guess that's a long way of saying that, you know, I think that this is a team that's not going to be as well known, but the identity of the program is still pretty solid. They've done a good job of being that tough blue collar team that wants to knock off the big guy. And I don't see any reason why that can't happen, why there isn't an expectation that will continue to happen for the Red Storm, for Jason Miller's team in 2015.
Terry, last but not least, you mentioned Marquette and Georgetown as those potential perennial top 5 teams. How far off are each of these teams from reaching that pinnacle?
I think that this is a year where you'll see, you know, it's tough. I was going to say tangible steps forward, but I think for Marquette especially, you've seen those tangible steps forward over the last 2 seasons. I think that the difference this year, for Georgetown, I think if things go the way that they expect them to, you're going to see a little bit more of the defensive personnel versatility that they need, which is a significant upgrade from what their expectations are, should be, can be. And then on the offensive end of the field, I think you might see a little bit more of their plan coming to fruition. They've got, you know, some interesting athletes. Stephen Quincy is a guy that I saw a fair amount in the fall and I was very impressed by. And they've got a couple of those guys in the midfield that can make a jump in their sophomore year. Right? You know, two guys that really strike out to me are Devin Lewis and Eduardo White. And if those guys do make that jump and they can complement, you know, some better known quantities, particularly at the attack, I think, you know, they're going to be a team that can push from behind the net and from up top, and they have wing shooters. I was impressed by what I saw at Georgetown in the fall. With Marquette, I think that they have an interesting, you know, kind of program question, and that is, you know, can they get enough teams to come to Milwaukee to play them to be able to have that be a part of who they are going forward? And I think that when you look at their schedule this year, you know, they still have those struggles in the early season, but they're settling into having a few more home games than they had in the previous 2 years, and that'll go a long way as well. So I think that there are a lot of things that could potentially happen in 2015 that show the positive signs of progress for both programs.
Terry, we appreciate your time as always. We'll look forward to Big Ten, CAA, and Ivy League next Sunday on the South Talk.
Thank you very much, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Terry.
That's Terry Foy, our NCAA Division One insider, joining us on Lacrosse Talk. And as always, Terry's time is greatly appreciated, and he seems to find time no matter where he is to jump on the phone and be with us. We apologize for any distortion that may have caused, but I think that Terry is so dedicated in his process, Max, that he really just will pick up the phone anytime and make it happen.
I feel like that's how a lot of our interviews with Terry are going to be moving forward, whether he's out and about or he's in the car or he's in the office working on the next issue or he's out at a game. He's our most loyal contributor, or one of our most loyal contributors, and like you said, he's going to pick up the phone, and I think he's a guy that loves to talk about lacrosse no matter what time of day it is, no matter where he's at. So I'm glad that we can help facilitate that for the editor-in-chief.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think same can be said for our next guest. He is our NCAA Division II and Division III insider. Today we'll take a look at Division II. It's Jack Coyne. Hi, Jack. How are you?
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Doing well. And yourself?
Just fine.
Are you getting enough rest in the Coyne household right now with number 4 in the house?
It's a little hectic, but actually the newest addition, our newest son, he's an easy one at this point. It's the older ones that make me pull my hair out.
Well, congratulations from us to you and your family. on number four. And let's get down to it. First big question for you, Terry, can Limestone repeat as the NCAA Division II champion?
Well, without a question. I think, you know, offensively, they're still stacked. They've got, in Sheridan, they've got one of the best goalie in the country coming back. There are a couple of questions with the loss of Anthony Starnino and a couple other defensemen. But, you know, they have these guys waiting in the wings that we don't really know about who have redshirted or are working off some transfer rule stuff. They'll have some competition by some of the teams in the South, notably Tampa and obviously in the North with the usual suspects. But, yeah, you know, our rankings are coming out here. I think they're in the magazine, but they're going to be released on the web. You know, Limestone at number one, no surprise, pretty easy pick.
Jack, thanks for joining us on the show. You mentioned Limestone going through some transfer rules, and I mean, with myself playing in Division II, you see a lot of these guys who are coming from Division I. Maybe things didn't work out. Maybe they wanted to move home, so they transferred down to Division II. Do you see any transfers who are coming in this year that we would need to know about? Are these guys who are going to be making an instant impact on the teams they're transferring to?
It's tough to say. You know, I talked to Gordon Purdy at Delphi, and he's got a transfer coming in from Stony Brook, who played a little bit for them. And I know, Nassau, you got some Nassau guys coming in. He's got a faceoff guy who's hoping to replace Greg Puskulgian, who was the top guy last year. So it's tough to say. You know, when I used to cover the club ranks, you know, the club players and our club coaches would tout that they'd have a Division I transfer coming in, and you know, sometimes they pan out, sometimes they don't. You kind of have to see if the proof's in the pudding. With Limestone, I was talking about, you know, they may have a JUCO kid who's coming in a semester early, so he's not eligible necessarily that spring, but we'll still have 2 years or 3 years of eligibility left. So those are the kind of guys that sort of float below the radar, and all of a sudden, you know, there's some great players, and I know they've got some Division I. I briefly heard you talking about Marquette. I think they've got a Marquette transfer coming in who's originally from New York, went to Marquette, now heading down there, I think he's a midfielder. But, you know, these guys always show up, especially in Division II, and even Division III, it's gotten a little bit more prevalent. And, you know, I wrote a story a couple of years ago just about the early recruiting phenomenon from a Division III perspective, and you know, all the coaches say they don't necessarily like early recruiting, but it can benefit them because you've got kids making choices when maybe they're not quite ready, and all of a sudden they find out that, you know, they weren't cut out for the D1 mentality, that kind of grind, and that the lower divisions are more their speed.
You mentioned all of these transfers, and there's nobody better at bringing in the transfer than Rory Whipple at the University of Tampa, who has all of his attack are transfers at this point. What will it take for Tampa to potentially jump into the conversation to be playing on championship Saturday or Sunday?
Oh, I think they're already in the conversation. They actually took a hit. I talked to Coach Whipple, when was it? I think it was Friday, and he said that Dan Rooney, a guy who scored 69, Jake Rooney, a Hofstra transfer who scored 69 goals for them last year, leading goal scorer, is not going to be playing this year because he suffered, I guess he had 6 concussions or something during his career, and he just made the decision that they weren't going to push that anymore. So he's going to graduate from Tampa, get his degree, but he's not playing. So that was a little bit of a sting. You know, you can't you assume that that's the right decision for a kid, you know, with all of the stuff we're starting to learn about concussions. But that'll be a little bit of a dent, but I know he's got some transfers coming in to fill that hole, and plus – you know, even some of the kids who have been waiting the wings will get a chance as well. So I think their big question mark will be on the defensive end. Their goalie play has been up and down, a little bit uneven, and I think that's hindered them in the past. If they can get that squared away, they'll be in good shape. I don't think they'll ever have a problem on the offensive end, just as you alluded to. Rory gets in these guys year after year from pretty quality programs, Division I, that can fill that void. But I think as we – the season goes forward, we have to keep an eye on the defense and how they're doing, especially against the top teams, because once again, Tampa's playing them all. And, I mean, they're going up to play Lake Erie up in Painesville, Ohio this year. So, I mean, they're even traveling. And I talked to Mike Morgan and confirmed it with Rory. I mean, they were talking about possibly flying up to Merrimack this year. They weren't able to get it done just money-wise and things like that. But, you know, he's willing to go out and play anybody, and I think that is attractive along with the campus and the weather. So, yeah, they're in the discussion right now. Wouldn't surprise me if they did win it. I mean, they'll have to beat some good teams, but if they were there on a championship Saturday, that would not be a surprise.
You mentioned the defense, Jack, and I know that they've got two coaching changes on that squad now. Mike Ryder and Dalton Jernigan have both moved on to other positions. How were those voids filled, and what impact will that have on this squad?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't follow the assistant coach ranks that closely. I guess I'd have to leave it at that. I'm not exactly sure. Rory, you know, he's got the connections, and I know he delegates quite a bit to his assistants, but I don't think that will be a factor on how high the ceiling is for this team. I mean, it'll come down to the horses. They've got a system in place. So, again, I can't answer your question specifically, but I would guess it's very minimal impact.
Jack, we see the majority of the talent coming on the Northern Conference for Division II, and a lot more teams and a lot more divisions coming in the South. So with the 8-team tournament bracket split up between four bids on each side, do you feel like there are more snubs coming from the North Conference because there are that many more better teams, or coming from the South because just the majority of teams in either – even teams from, let's say, the WILA or the South Atlantic that win their conference still don't make it into the tournament?
Well, you're touching on a very hot topic right now. It was at the IMLCA convention. It was a hot topic there. I've talked to a lot of coaches. It's a hot topic. Now, within the next couple of weeks, the NCAA Division II committee is going to give its recommendation to the championship, the greater championship committee at the NCAA, in terms of realigning the division, or the regions in Division II. Right now you have your North and your South, each get four bids, but the South has 37 teams this year, the North only has 22. And when you have one bid per every 7.3 teams, that's two bids worth of teams, discrepancy you have. So they're going to be moving something or somebody or some conference this year, or recommending for next year. And it's got a lot of people off guard because there's three options. One, the WILA is going to get moved into the North. Two, the ECAC is going to get moved into the North. Or they're going to break up the ECAC and send some of its teams to the North, keep some of its teams in the South. Essentially, it's Mercyhurst. The North doesn't want them in their region, and the South doesn't want them in their region because they're so good and they're always in the hunt. So basically, that decision is going to come down, and there's people lobbying. There was a very heated conversation, from what I've been told, at the IMLCA about where the discrepancy should be made up from. It looks like the ECAC may get shifted into the North, which would even up the numbers, but now you're going to have a region that already had NYIT and Merrimack as snubs last year to get into the tournament, and now you're adding Mercyhurst, Lake Erie, and Seton Hill into that mix. So it could cause an absolute glut of top-end teams in the North and in the South, which is still growing. And as you said, most of the growth is in the South. You're going to have real access to bids now. Teams that were not even really in the hunt are going to be players for a bid this year, and it may lead to some lopsided scores early on, but it'll be egalitarian in terms of access to the tournament.
How far off might they be, Jack, from extending the tournament from 8 to 12 or 16 teams?
I think they're a ways off. I think there's still the NCAA was generous at the time to go to 8 teams, as it were, so they've still got to make up some time. And as I understand it, talking to some coaches, the only way that they're going to go to an AQ system like you have in Division III, where conferences get an automatic bid, then you have maybe that large pool. I guess you have to have a 64-team bracket in Division II in order to go that AQ route. So that's not happening anytime soon when you figure that Division III has four times as many teams and they only have a 32-team bracket. So, it looks like that will be coming down 16. A lot of coaches are pushing for any alignment in the regions to go to 17 so that they can sort of tweak their schedules, because a lot of them go 2 years out in their scheduling. And if they change the regions, they'd have some dead games on their schedule. So that's the push now. I've got a story coming out with it next week sort of explaining it all, but that's sort of the hot topic right now.
Jack, we see new teams popping up in every division. It seems like four or five a piece every season. And we know how important it is for those new teams to get off to a hot start in order for them to continue that success and try and bring in the best possible recruits. Who do you see in the field of Division II who is new to the NCAA making that kind of impact and coming out of the gates hot in their first year?
Well, I'm not sure if we can say that. You know, we've got North Greenville, and I know we've got some Florida teams about to come online, Embry-Riddle and Palm Beach Atlantic. Palm Beach Atlantic had some success in the MCLA ranks when they were there, but they'll be moving shortly. I'm not sure if you'll ever be able to match what Tampa has been able to do. I mean, Tampa is very much an anomaly in terms of teams starting up and having that kind of success right away. I don't see any of the new teams having that ability. Maybe in the Florida, if you had a little bit of a run-up, and that's another key. A lot of these teams and programs are added, and they're starting within 18 months. If you have a little bit of a run-up, maybe 2 years, you get your coach in place, and you can recruit and get things established, you might be able to match that. But Rory has got connections everywhere. He can recruit everywhere. You know, he's got all these New York kids coming down. He's used Tampa as a way, you know, the weather and the school and everything like that as a way to lure all these kids, especially transfers. You know, but he has had the background. He's been coaching forever. He knows how to do it. He started up other programs like Florida Southern. So I don't know if you'll ever have that perfect storm again in Division II like that, or even in Division III. And, you know, you just go back to Division I when Michigan made the move. You know, they were the cat's meow and the MCLA thinking, oh, they'll move right into Division I, you know, and I don't think they have a .500 record yet, do they? So, I mean, it's very difficult to do, and I would say Tampa is maybe the only one to ever do it.
So, Jack, I mean, still looking at the South, and like you said, the disparity between the number of teams on each side, who do you feel like one of these teams from a smaller conference, maybe a Colorado Mesa or a Queens or a Lenoir Rhyne, if they beat the right people, could find their way into the tournament in 2015?
Yeah, Queens run last year when they got in as basically the fourth seed in the South. That opened a lot of eyes. But again, you have to win the games. You have to win because Pfeiffer was right there. I would say they've got a chance at it. You know, Queens, again, they play a great schedule this year. So if they win the right games, they could return to the tournament in 15. You know, they earned their way in last year, the first game against Limestone in the quarterfinals. You know, it wasn't pretty. You know, they lost by 11 goals, 17-6, and that was the most lopsided by far of any of the divisional games or NCAA games. So, I see several. You know, Lenoir Rhyne could be a possibility. You know, maybe outside of the box, maybe like a Wingate or Catawba or something like that. But if they switch the regions, then you're going to see a lot more access and a lot more up-and-coming teams, St. Louis being another one that may get a chance at the NCAA tournament.
Who are going to be some of the players that we should keep an eye on in Division II this year, Jack?
Well, Luke Miller, obviously, out of NYIT, probably the best player in the country from an attack standpoint, followed quickly by Sal Tuttle at Adelphi. I was talking to Paul Cantabene down at Stevenson. He scrimmaged Adelphi in the fall, and I was talking to him a little bit about Sal Tuttle. And I guess Tuttle went off for 11 points against Stevenson in a scrimmage. So I know Paul Cantabene is a big fan of Sal Tuttle and what he can do. You know, there in the South, you know, Radigan from Limestone is a guy who I think is going to have a breakout year. Vinny Ricci's coming back. He'll be should have another strong year. Their goalie Sheridan is somebody to look out for. Connor Whipple, Rory Whipple's son, had close to 90 points last year, both as an assist guy and a scorer. He's somebody to keep an eye out for. And then, you know, there's some up-and-coming guys who may break onto the scene this year. You know, Robbie Choco at LIU Post is a defenseman, but I think he's one of the best players in the country at his position, sort of in that Anthony Starnino mold. He's just a real tough kid, gritty, and he was a big part of their run last year. to the championship game. LeMoyne, they always have great players. Kevin Kelly is an attackman who I think could have a breakout year. They have a tough system where they don't necessarily have that many high-number guys. They just sort of play their style, and they're very efficient at it. And then there's a couple of secondary guys, but those are probably the guys to keep an eye on.
Jack, as always, we appreciate the time. We'll look forward to chatting with you in a couple of weeks about D3.
Sounds good. Happy New Year, guys. We'll talk to you soon.
And to you.
Same to you. Thanks, Jack.
Bye-bye.
That's Jack Coyne, our NCAA Division II, Division III insider, with his sneak peek at what Division II looks like this year. Some really good information so far, Max, from Tim, Terry, and Jack.
And it's only just going to get more in-depth. I mean, on the field side of things, we haven't even hit the field yet. Nobody's played a game in NCAA or in clubs. So all we can do now is just kind of look at what happened in the past, what's coming into this year. I think one of the biggest things that we had talked about with Jack was the transfers. And I don't think many people realize how many teams in Division II really benefit from guys coming from Division I, top Division III programs, junior colleges, like he said, Nassau County, and then a lot of those on the East Coast, these guys who are playing incredible lacrosse and then decide to transfer over to maybe the West Coast, possibly even some of the better teams, try and jump on a championship team in Division II. A lot of these guys who you see lighting up the scoreboards may not have necessarily been recruited by their coaches in Division II, but found a good fit for them or found something that was close to home, something that was a little bit more manageable for them. And that's how you see these teams like Tampa in their first year got a ton of good transfers. Colorado Mesa, while I was there, had a lot of good transfers. Dominican, I'm not too sure about the guys from the northern side of things, but still, you see a lot of these guys from Division II who didn't either pan out in Division I, wanted to play at a lower level. That's where you see a lot of the talent in D2.
Yeah, you mentioned Tampa. What Rory Whipple has done at the University of Tampa is really unprecedented. To have moved them to be a perennial, they are now a perennial power, and that's a squad that will never falter. I mean, you talk about location, you talk about coach, you talk about facilities. The University of Tampa all has it, and that's why Rory Whipple has been so successful and drawing these transfers that just maybe weren't cut out for what it takes to play D1 or top level D3 lacrosse. And so you feed into a program like Tampa, or like you mentioned, Mesa, and you all of a sudden you're finding your playing time and you're putting a quality product on the field. Speaking of quality products on the field, our next guest is a quality product who talks about a quality product with us every week during the National Lacrosse League season. That's Brian Shanahan, our NLL insider. Shanny, the NLL season has gotten off to a bang, so to speak, in the first couple of weeks.
Oh, absolutely. Last week we thought there was a couple of upsets, but it was nothing compared to what we had in week two. You know, Rochester, the defending champs, you know, the finalists, Calgary, and, you know, Edmonton, the record-breaking team from last year, all lost their first games last week in what, you know, like I said, maybe mild upsets. But this week, all three of those teams lost again, and a couple of them were shockers. Rochester, you know, went into New England and got beat 17-7 against, the New England Black Wolves, a team that most of us figured would be, you know, the bottom of the heap in the league. And Edmonton, you know, had a 9-3 lead late in the third quarter against, you know, Minnesota Swarm, not one of the powerhouses in the league, and they ended up getting outscored 11-1 the rest of the way, losing that game. So those two games are shockers. My power rankings this week are going to look like they're upside down.
If I had to guess, you're going to still have Toronto up top, and Colorado's going to be right behind them.
You're absolutely right. In fact, I've been sitting writing them this morning, and let me just take a peek here. And yes, you're right. Toronto's first, and I have Colorado second. And both those teams have looked pretty impressive. You know, the Toronto Rock, they got a big win on the road last week against Rochester. They always play each other tough, but then this week they really just demolished the Vancouver Stealth in Vancouver. After a slow start, the Rock was down 3-0, same as they were last week against Rochester. But once the Rock responded, Vancouver looked like they were simply in shock. And Colorado also had a great game. And, you know, every time Colorado and Calgary meet, it's a great game. Last year, including the playoffs, they played each other four times, and three of those games went to overtime. So, of course, you know, last night shouldn't be a big surprise that we had a barn burner. But, you know, those 15,000 fans, 15-plus in Colorado must have gone home happy after that game. And, of course, you know, the ageless Johnny Grant scored the winning goal in overtime. No surprise there.
Now, Brian, I mean, I know that lacrosse is a game of runs, especially in the box game because the field is so short. And you're used to seeing these 3-4 goal runs and these kind of momentum shifts, lead changes. But 8-goal runs, 11-goal runs, 13-2 runs by some of these teams. I mean, is that just the incredible offenses that are in the NLL this year, or is there some pretty sloppy defense going on early on in the season?
I think things are crazy right now. I mean, I don't know if you could say it's sloppy defense or the incredible offense. I think it's just one of these weird things that's happening. And you mentioned like 11-goal runs. Like last week, Vancouver Stealth scored 11 straight goals against Calgary. And I don't know, you know, that's a record they have to research because I don't know if they keep records of the longest runs, but I have never seen in the NLL an 11-goal run without an interruption. And 11 seems to be the magic number this year because, as I mentioned, Minnesota last week, well, against Colorado, Minnesota was in a tight game when Colorado outscored them 11-1 in the fourth quarter. And then last night, Minnesota did the same thing to Edmonton, I believe, outscoring them 11-2 down the stretch. So, lacrosse is a game for runs. You know, I do the games on TV, and we always make sure we tell our viewers that, you know, when a team goes up by 5 or 6 goals, like, don't go away because lacrosse is a game of runs, and we could see them. But I have never seen the type of runs we've seen, you know, over these first two games of the season. And then especially, you know, having teams as good as, you know, the Edmonton Rush and the Rochester Nighthawks, like, the top three teams in everybody's preseason predictions were Rochester, Edmonton, Calgary. Not necessarily in that order, but those were the top three teams. They're 0-6 between the three of them right now. It's ridiculous. I mean, I still expect things to straighten out eventually, but you know, at this point in the season, it's really is shocking.
And I know it's early on in the season with Rochester being 0-2 and all, but, I mean, after the game they played against New England last night, I mean, it wasn't really much of a contest. Rochester didn't even have the opportunity to go on any runs to try and get back into this game, and they didn't exactly handle the loss well. There were two fights in the game, one at the beginning of the second quarter and one at the very end of the game. Is there a little bit of tension going on in Rochester right now with this early slump?
Well, they must be a little bit worried because, you know, they made a big trade before the season. You know, they traded, you know, Johnny Paulus and Joel McCready. Now, Johnny Paulus scored 30 goals last year, but he wasn't their superstar. I mean, it really, you know, he was behind Cody Jamison and Dan Dawson. And same with Joel McCready. Joel McCready was probably like a 15-goal scorer, but a good player. But sometimes your chemistry gets tweaked and it's just not there. It just doesn't come easy. And that's what it almost looks like so far this year, that there's something wrong with the chemistry. And it's remarkable that they have won three championships in a row. Like, everything right has to happen to do that. No matter how good you are, there's bumps along the ways and injuries, and you got to have a bit of luck. But so far this year, it looks like they're being paid back for all the good luck they've had in the past years because it's just not working for them. I still think it will turn around, but, you know, nothing's for sure. I mean, their goal is always win the championship or bust. And, you know, if they didn't win the championship this year, I think everybody figures they're the favorite team. But maybe it's just, you know, those changes have affected the chemistry. That's what it looks like. I know Stephen Keel is also out with injury. So there's three starters from their lineup from last year that are not in. As I said, they were not the most dominant players, but they were all part of the puzzle and important parts of the puzzle.
Shani, a two-part question for you regarding the Black Wolves. This is in large part a very similar team to what we saw in Philadelphia. A, what's been their key to success so far? B, are they for real?
I'll answer B first. I don't think they're for real over the long run. And I don't want to take anything away from them because they do have I like what they've done so far. Like Kevin Crowley is a world-class superstar. We know that. We saw what he did on the world stage in the summer. And, you know, he is a superstar. So anytime you have a superstar, good things can happen. I've been really impressed with what the guys like Pat Saunders and Kyle Buchanan have done. They've each scored hat-tricks over their first two games. Plus, they've had good goaltending. Evan Kirk has played very well in both of his starts. So I think that things have just worked well for them. I saw them in the preseason, and they were not impressive at all. The Toronto Rock handled them easily in a preseason game that featured most of the starters. It was late in the preseason schedule. So both teams had most of their starters playing that game, and I thought this was going to be a long season for them. But, you know, I'll give them credit. You know, those guys have scored the goals they needed. They've got great goaltending, and they're working hard. I just don't think they are deep enough to do it all season. I still would be very surprised if they were a playoff team at the end of the year.
So, Brian, you mentioned it's been a pretty wacky start first 2 weeks of the NLL season, and for you covering the Toronto Rock, it must have been pretty cool to see a 14-point performance coming from Josh Sanderson. Can you just describe a little bit of how he was able to take over that game, see the field so well, because 14 or 10 of those 14 were assists and 14 of the 20 total points came from Josh Sanderson. So what was watching that performance like for you?
You know, Josh Sanderson, his whole career has been like that. He really has probably been the dominant assist player, you know, throughout the last 15, 20 years in the NLL. He's always been, you know, even though his nickname is Shooter, he is really a setup man, and he always has been. He's you know, at times he's held the record for most assists in a season. It's been broken, but he's always been up there around 70 assists, so that's always been his strength. He sees the floor so well. He's always got his head up when he has the ball, and he's always got his stick cocked ready to make a pass. So he's always been very skillful at that. I just amazing that there have been a number of times where people have thought that you know, Josh was on the downside of his career. When he was traded out of Toronto back in, I believe it was 2008, and I think a lot of people thought he was finished then, and he went on to have a couple of seasons of over 100 points in Calgary and won a championship and an MVP. You know, and came back to Toronto. His numbers aren't the same as they have been, but, you know, if there is a guy that's motivated, you know, coming into the season, you know, he was very close to his father, Terry Sanderson, who just died, and his father, you know, was always a great believer in what Josh could do. I remember Josh coming into the league 20 years ago, getting barely any floor time the first season and talking to his dad about it, and he just said, you know, he's been able to put up points wherever he's played, and when he gets the chance, he'll do it in the NLL. And you know, and he's done that in a big way. So I'm not really surprised at how well Josh is playing. I guess I would be lying though if I didn't say I was surprised, you know, at the number of points. I expect him to lead this team or be one of the leaders, but to put up 21 points in two games is ridiculous. And you know, it's funny because the NLL has added an award this year for the assist leader, well, not necessarily the leader, but the player who proves to be the best playmaker of the week. Josh won it the first week. I guess, you know, for the most part, you think it'll go to the guy who gets the most assists. Well, he got 7 assists the first week and won the award. How are they not going to give it to him in week 2 when he picked up 10 assists? And that might be an award that he might keep on his shelf for, you know, most of this winter.
Shani, as always, we appreciate it. We'll look forward to seeing the power rankings on IL Indoor tomorrow morning and chatting with you again next week about the National Lacrosse League.
Excellent, guys. Good talking to you.
Thank you, Brian.
You're welcome.
That's Brian Shanahan, our NLL insider, joining us here on Lacrosse Talk today. We're going to keep this train rolling. We're going to talk with the New England Black Wolves head coach, Blaine Harrison. Blaine, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. How are you guys doing?
Doing well, thanks. We sure appreciate you taking the time to join us on a Sunday morning. And you guys had a nice home game and had a great performance last night. What's the atmosphere like at the Mohegan Sun?
There's multi levels of it. There's the initial wow factor as you walk into the resort. It's something that, you know, most of our players, you know, haven't been used to in any kind of context, you know, let alone a lacrosse context. So you know, usually are looking at, you know, small barns and small communities in Ontario in the summer leagues, and then, you know, traditional hockey rinks in the NLL. So you come to Mohegan Sun and you're coming to a, you know, five-star resort first and foremost. So you realize you're not Kansas anymore, and then you get into the arena, which is probably a little bit smaller than obviously the what we're used to from a hockey arena, NHL hockey arena perspective. But it's different in a nice way. It's you know, almost, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, it could be the future of the NLL in terms of being able to put together a package in something that's not an NHL hockey arena and make it work. So the atmosphere is, I don't want to call it cozy, but it is kind of cozy. The fans are on top of you. They're loud. They're into it. They're appreciative of the fact that that they have lacrosse to watch, and it's been a good experience so far.
Coach, appreciate you joining us on the show this morning, and congratulations on the win over the reigning champs. As far as the game plan goes for Rochester, obviously priority number one is keep Cody Jamison from getting the ball, keep him from beating you. You guys did that very successfully, kept him off the board as far as scoring goes. How were you guys able to put a complete game together, both defensively and offensively, with Kevin Crowley just going off to take down the Nighthawks?
Yeah, I mean, I think that your first statement is right. I mean, we came into the game, and from a preparation standpoint, there was a couple of things we wanted to key on. Cody, obviously, is one from the left side, Dan Dawson on the right side, and Vino, you know, Matt Vincent in net. So we had to kind of – we felt we had to solve those three problems. And, you know, the coaches put together, pretty good preparation to address it all. We know this year we've kind of changed our strategic makeup defensively, you know, both personnel-wise and systems-wise. So, you know, with Kirky, you know, playing for Six Nations in the summer and playing kind of a packed-in, you know, we call it diagonal slope defense, you know, we felt that it was imperative that we kind of adjust and migrate to that style of play. It's taken a while, and you saw in the preseason that we took our lumps in a couple of games, you know, as we adjusted to it. So the more we felt that we could, you know, get into lanes and you know, be disruptive, from could have some success. And then from an offensive perspective, you know, we felt that if we were able to move their defense and open up lanes for ourselves, that it was just a matter of time before Kevin Crowley, you know, went off, and was fortunate for us that last night he did. And you know, he certainly felt good about himself, and rightfully so. You know, when you can score six goals in this league, that's not a small feat. So the fact that he was able to get off and you know, start building some confidence was pretty good for us.
Coach, historically, this franchise has been known as the Great American Experiment from their time in Philly. The team is now in New England. It's playing its games at the Mohegan Sun, has a new identity, at least externally, as the Black Wolves. What are you as a coach and the rest of the group as a franchise doing to rebrand and re-identify this team and create something completely different from what it was?
You know, I think I guess I never saw it as the Great American Experiment. I think just from an economics perspective, you know, Philadelphia was, you know, kind of the only team left on the Eastern Seaboard, and you know, and there's a lot of talent there. I mean, it's not necessarily indoor talent, but it's lacrosse talent and it's athletic talent. So we felt, you know, why not try to harvest that talent? And I think that was really more of the of the emphasis than, hey, let's try to put an American product on the floor. I think the as we move to Mohegan Sun and we have a different kind of ownership group, it kind of opened up the door a little bit to look beyond just our backyard. So, we've had the opportunity to bring in some guys like Mike McNamara, as an example, who, is a defender, as everyone knows, young defender who plays the type of the defensive system in summer league that we wanted to bring to our team. So, having moved to New England, we were able to now look at, hey, what's the best available talent out there that fits the needs that we're trying to accomplish from a strategic standpoint. And, we've been blessed that the ownership group has given us the resources to go after that talent base.
You are listening to Lacrosse Talk, North America's first and most comprehensive show dedicated to the sport. Max Frater and Dan Matthews here with the head coach of the New England Black Wolves. Coach, three straight home games to start off the 2015 NLL season. You got Minnesota coming up next week. What's the plan to make sure that you guys go 3-0 and keep this hot streak alive?
Well, first of all, I think we got to, we had our 24 hours, or we soon will have our 24 hours of, Rochester was a measuring stick for us. And I'm not going to say that, 17-7 score is any kind of end game. It was, I would look at that more of an anomaly than anything else. But facing those guys was a big test for us early in the season, because it was going to, can we play? We're young, but can we really play and be competitive? So we felt really good about the result, obviously, last night. We've got to quickly get that behind us. And to your point, look at, Mini coming at us. They're a very fast young team themselves, and we'll have to prepare ourselves for that kind of a track meet. So, we'll take the week to kind of heal some bumps and bruises, take care of our bodies, and then come back the week after and prepare for what is going to be kind of a unique team for us. Buffalo and Rochester, I wouldn't say necessarily are the same team, but they play similar styles in many ways. Mini is a little bit different, so we're going to have to, look at some tape and tap into some of our collective experiences playing against them over the years and figure out the best way to attack them.
Coach, we sure appreciate your time on Lacrosse Talk. We'll look forward to many more times like this during the course of the season.
I look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Blaine.
Thank you, Coach.
That's Blaine Harrison, head coach of the New England Black Wolves, joining us on Lacrosse Talk. And exciting times in the New England area. And we started the show off with the MCLA. We're going to end it with the MCLA today, and a little bit of bonus coverage here on Lacrosse Talk. We've got the CEO of Tilt Clothing Company, Jake Hubert, who played his collegiate at North Dakota State University, joining us. Jake, how are you today?
I'm doing well, guys. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. Jake, you and I have chatted a bit online, but the basics, who, what, where, when, and why Tilt Clothing Company?
Yeah. Excellent. So, first off, thanks for having me on the show. Really appreciate it. Tilt, we're coming up on a year in April. That'll be 1 year. And it really roots itself back into when I was in my college playing years. We just saw a void in a real, basically an offering that the game was lacking for clothing for our demographic in the college scene. There was the monkeys and the bananas and the funky wild colors, and although some of it might have been cool, and it was more geared towards the youth, and we realized that void, and so we felt that it could be filled. We recognized it, we wanted to fill it. It would really resonate, and that's really kind of how Kit was born.
Appreciate you joining us on the show as well. In my playing days, when it came to lacrosse clothing, it was about flash. And as you said, you've got the banana shorts, and neon is usually a big thing, whether it be pink, whether it be green, you name it. Loud and flashy is the way that lacrosse clothing tends to be. That's what kids are wearing. Is that what Tilt is all about?
Good question. So, although we don't shy away from being loud and flashy, but I feel as if we are loud, flashy, edgy in a different way. It's more so in our persona and the character, the story we're building and telling through our brand. Our items ourselves, when we go through the design phase of the items, we try to actually bring in inspiration from more of the skate, surf, snow lifestyle, because, you know, it's becoming more and more blurred, the lines, the parallels between the two markets. And turns out, you know, I've been talking with a lot of the pros and, you know, my colleagues, the guys I used to play with, and we all grew up either skateboarding or surfing or snowboarding, and they bring a lot of that into the sport and their fashion and how they represent themselves and their lifestyle. So as far as the bright neon, you know, cartoon sort of feel, we don't directly incorporate that into our designs per se, but you will see a lot of edgy, loud, in-your-face sort of vibe from our marketing, our website, and just like I had mentioned, the persona and the character that we are building as a brand.
Your three key spokesmen are Cam Holding, Dylan Ward, both of the Colorado Mammoth, and Jordan Hall. Why those three, and how was the connection made? Was it initially made with Cam through the MCLA?
Yeah, real good questions. So in the search of, you know, who we would really want to work with and have a part of the, you know, be part of the organization and really be able to, you know, like you had mentioned, sort of be the face of the program or the company from a player point of view. We first brought on Halsey. Obviously, great guy, awesome player. I went down to Connecticut, watched him play last night. We brought him on initially through, you know, it was kind of through like a second connection. Brought him on, things were great. And then, you know, I reached out to Cam because, yeah, I did play against him in college. And, you know, he was following us on Twitter, and I was like, oh, yeah, like, Cam, that's, you know, been a long time, haven't talked to him in a while. I was like, let's reach out to him. So we started discussing, talking, and it made sense. And so we brought him on as well. And then Dylan Wardo actually contacted Cam and said, hey, what's Till? You know, what's this all about? And Cam explained the whole vision of the company and where we're shooting to be, what we're doing today. And, you know, Dylan thought it seemed pretty cool. So that opened up that conversation with him, and we have these three great players and representatives of the company.
So what is the goal with Tilt Clothing? Are you guys looking to be the outfitters for club ball in the summer and late springtime? Are you guys looking to be making jerseys, possibly go into equipment? What's the vision for Tilt Lacrosse?
Great question. The vision, you know, we're strictly, our vision is to stay strictly off of the field. So we don't want to get into equipment. We don't want to get into jerseys. What we really want to focus on, laser focus on, is really bringing the fashion style to the sport so guys and potentially gals in the future can have something that they want to wear that they know is a lacrosse brand, but it's casual wear. You wear it out after the game, out to the restaurant, the after party, the cabin in the summer, wherever, right? But it's that brand, it's that image that they can wear. Now, what it looks like in the future is, up to this point, you know, we've pretty much nailed down the fundamental products, right? We have the hats, the tees, the tanks, sweatshirt. But in the future, what that looks like is, you know, we really want to continue broadening the breadth of our product line and offerings. And what that means is, you know, since, you know, we really actually call ourselves a streetwear company. That's kind of how we classify ourselves, streetwear. That being said, we're truly going to be a streetwear, and that's our vision, which it is. You know, we want to stick to that and to really, in our eyes, become that streetwear brand for lacrosse. We need to do more unique stuff. And by unique, really more or less something, you know, clothing that people see and they say, that's Till, and they're not confusing it with any other brand out there. You know, Warrior, Adrenaline, there should be no confusion. They see this and they say, that's a Till piece, that's a Till item. You know, I want that. I need that.
Jake, what are your current core products, and what do you foresee those core products being in the future?
So currently right now, our T-shirts are our core products. They're our biggest sellers, especially Selly Hard. It's our blue, it's a nice heather blue T-shirt with an orange graphic of a king. It looks like a playing card, a king, and we kind of subtly put in a lacrosse stick in his hand. That's not totally noticeable right off the bat. That's been our number one seller, along with a few other T-shirts. Moving into the future, I still foresee T-shirts being, you know, a big hit. T-shirts are classic, right? They never go out of style. You can always kind of alter the graphic to fit into whatever's trending. So T-shirts are always going to be a staple for us. But, you know, that being said, I could definitely see, you know, as I mentioned, as we're entering into a new design phase and being able to produce more one-of-a-kind, you know, unique items, I can see, you know, some of those items when we're working with different fabrics, cuts, et cetera, I could see some of those maybe being big sellers as well, just because they're different. And currently lacrosse right now, we feel, again, is missing that void. It doesn't have that level of design and style that is specifically geared for the lacrosse community.
My style usually tends to cross over. I'll use my lacrosse gear as streetwear as well. Sometimes it works out. Usually it's just me repping pennies during the summer. So it'd be nice to kind of separate the two, have some streetwear, have lacrosse gear. For those of us who are looking to get into or to find some lacrosse streetwear, where can we find your products?
Excellent. Yeah, so definitely head over to tiltclothingco.com. It's the website. Currently, we sell everything through the site. However, we are now approaching retailers in 2015. So that being said, you know, this is a good time for me to push it out there that if anyone does listening or anyone who is listening and knows of a shop near them that they would really, you know, feel this would be a product that they want to see in the store would do really well, tweet at us. Go on our site, email us, and we will do what we can to really speak with the individuals over that store and get it in there because, you know, that is 2015, we will be in retail.
Jake, we appreciate your time and look forward to building a lasting relationship with Tilt Clothing Co.
Excellent, guys. Thanks again so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jake. Good luck.
Thank you.
That's Jake Hubert joining us on Lacrosse Talk to talk about his product, Tilt Clothing Company. Go online, find them at tiltclothingco.com, and make sure you let them know that the guys from Lacrosse Talk sent you on over. What a show, Max. We've got our spring season previews underway. We're heavy and deep into the early season ranks of the National Lacrosse League. And what more can we ask for?
Strange times, as you heard from Brian, with the kind of offense that we're seeing on the NLL side of things. Can't wait for field ball to start. I mean, just this time of year, whether I'm suiting up to go play on the field or whether I'm covering it, I mean, I always get excited when it's coming around springtime because you know there are going to be so many good games, and we're going to be covering all of them.
Yeah, we're going to be busy this spring. We will have a major announcement for Lacrosse Talk on next week's show. So make sure you stay tuned to Lacrosse Talk. Follow us on Twitter at @lacrosse_talk. And lots of big things happening for Lacrosse Talk and within the lacrosse world. Want to thank all of our guests again. Tim Haslam, our MCLA insider. Terry Foy, our NCAA Division I insider. And Brian Shanahan, our NLL insider. Jack Coyne, the NCAA Division II insider for Lacrosse Talk. Blaine Harrison, head coach of the New England Black Wolves. And Jake Hubert, CEO of Tilt Clothing Company. That's going to do it for another episode of Lacrosse Talk. Until next week, so long, everybody.